Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Saturday, June 6th, and we have today's reading of the Boston Globe being read to you by Karen and Mary Beth. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Taking a look at the world news, this headline that the Russian satellites are jamming GPS signals in Europe. This tech disruption is concerning, even if it's unintentional. Russian satellites have caused seconds-long GPS outages across Europe on several occasions, according to new research provided to the New York Times by scientists who specialize in GPS technology and a person familiar with a U.S. Air Force briefing on the jamming. The findings are part of two research projects which concluded that in at least three of the 75 instances that they identified since 2019, the interference originated from Russian satellites. While they suspect the remaining cases implicate the same Russian network, they say the available data is not granular enough to pinpoint the culprit. But in all the incidents, the same type of signal appears to be causing the interference. The scientists have been unable to determine the Russians' motives or if they even know whether their satellite signals are interfering with GPS services. But what concerns experts is that this activity, whether nefarious or incidental, it can go on uninterrupted for years and can disrupt a technology so foundational to the modern world. An EU spokesperson said they're building a system to detect and locate the interference, among other measures, to defend the critical navigation signals. The press office for the Russian embassy in Washington, D.C. said, as for now, we don't have a comment on that, they said. Senior U.S. Air Force officials were briefed on the interference, according to a person familiar with the briefing who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal government assessments. The person confirmed that the interference was occurring and that the Russian satellite network was responsible, but didn't specify the quantity of incidents or the intent. The findings are part of a research project published on Thursday by Todd Humphreys, who is head of the Radio Navigation Laboratory at the University of Texas in Austin, as well as research conducted separately by Richard Bowden and a fellow navigation expert at the large Spanish technology firm GMV. Most jamming works by producing a strong, noisy signal on or adjacent to the same frequency as a GPS signal. Scientists liken it to how a person shouting in a room will drown out a person speaking at a whisper. In this case, the disrupting satellites are sending signals adjacent to a widely used GPS frequency, and they are strong enough to bleed over. The disruptions occur almost entirely in Europe, and they affect the GPS networks of the U.S., China, and the European Union, though not Russia's. The interruptions have affected devices from Iceland to Italy, but are fleeting, lasting less than 10 seconds at a time. They haven't caused major disruptions, since most devices are able to draw on a user's last known position to navigate for a short period of time or briefly resort to a backup signal. These cases are among the first known examples of GPS interference originating from space. The other two publicly known cases of satellites, one Chinese and one American, interfering with GPS signals were the result of one-off technical glitches causing interference on lesser used frequencies. But even if the interference is unintentional, researchers, academics, and former military officers have serious concerns about the threat that jamming from space poses to GPS. While it's possible to jam from the ground or a ship or a plane, they all have significantly less range than a satellite. Dana Goward, who is head of the Resilient Navigation and Timing Foundation, which advocates more secure GPS infrastructure, explained that GPS services are not just found in consumer-consuming apps like Uber or Lyft, but do everything from synchronizing electrical grids and cell towers to generating critical alerts for aircraft. Despite its important role in everyday life, experts said it's often taken for granted, saying that GPS is just like electricity, said General William Shelton, who is the former commander of the U.S. Air Force Space Command. He said, you put a plug in the wall and expect power to be there. Same thing with GPS, he said. Non-space-based jamming is increasingly used as a method of electronic warfare in Europe and the Middle East, but it has usually affected devices in relatively small areas, since the jammed devices must be within sight of the transmitter emitting the interference signal. But with space-based jammers, someone could, if they wanted to, selectively jam an entire continent every day, said Ramsey Ferger, who is head of the Royal Institute of Navigation in London.
From the cover of today's Boston Globe, at Bunker Hill, an edit to history. The U.S. orders quotes about slaves, immigrants, and war removed from banners at the monument. The story by Tanya Alanez and Brian McQuarrie and Lauren Albano. The National Park Service has ordered three quotes removed from the banners at the Bunker Hill monument that comment on American slavery, the contributions of immigrants, and the purpose of war memorials. The quotes hang in the Bunker Hill Lodge, which serves as an entrance to the 220-foot-high monument, and flanked a statue of Patriot leader Joseph Warren, who was killed June 17, 1775, in the first large-scale battle of the Revolution. Staffer U.S. Senator Edward Markey confirmed the quotes are due to be removed. At the park on Friday, National Park Service Rangers declined to comment on when the quotes would be taken down. The planned removal, first reported by the Washington Post, marks another move by federal officials to erase interpretive language at national parks and elsewhere that speaks to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Some preservationists equate the move with government censorship. Censoring the contributions of any people that came before us would go against the very ideals that were fought for at this place, said Kristen Sykes, Northeast Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association, an advocacy group. Our national parks belong to all of us. Visitors deserve the chance to learn our struggles and triumphs alike, free of government censorship. The targeted quotes include one from the 19th century abolitionist who mocked the existence of American slavery 70 years after the battle. Another assails the anti-immigrant sentiment in the United States that proliferated a century after the Revolutionary encounter. And a third from anti-war Vietnam veterans argues that memorials should honor the living rather than the dead. Markey called the removal censorship. The Trump administration's patriotism is weak enough to be threatened by American voices and American history, so they try to silence it with the implicit consent of Republicans in Congress, he said. And on Friday, Governor Maura Healey assailed the decision as a disgrace. The plan to remove the quotes comes as the 251st anniversary of the Battle of Bunker Hill is approaching. It also comes about a year after the Trump administration targeted national park signs, statues, and other public monuments that inappropriately disparage Americans past or living. A spokesperson for the Interior Department, which oversees the Park Service, pushed back against the criticism. Efforts to transform a routine exhibit refresh into a story attacking President Trump, and this administration is tired, and the American people see through it, the spokesperson said in a statement to the Globe. Through President Trump, we have encouraged Americans to visit our cultural and historical sites and engage in meaningful conversations about the moments that have shaped our country, the spokesperson said. One of the three quotes targeted for removal was written by G.B. Stebbins to Boston abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison on May 22, 1846. As we drew near to Boston, there stood Bunker Monument, towering up towards the heavens, as if in silent, bitter mockery of the millions of slaves guarded by the professed loves of liberty who reared its lofty columns, Stebbins wrote. Another quote came from an anti-war editorial printed in the Boston Globe in 1971 by Arthur Johnson and Bester Cram of the Vietnam War Veterans Against the War. "We find, upon reflection, that our duty to our country has not ended. We, as Vietnam veterans, strongly feel that the United States should cease to build memorials to death and begin to glorify life," they wrote. The third quote was published May 8, 1875, in The Pilot, the newspaper of the Archdiocese of Boston, and was addressed to our Irish societies. At the time, the Charlestown neighborhood around the monument had been heavily settled by Irish immigrants. "Now that a public orator has declared that foreign-born men have no association with the men of the Revolution, it is our duty to show that in love of freedom and loyalty to the Republic, the citizens of foreign birth take no second place," the quote said. The Post reported that a federal review of the site's materials followed a complaint by a visitor who complained that another quote related to women's suffrage represented woke feminist ideology. But several tourists who were visiting the monument on Friday questioned the plan to remove the quotes. Jason Powell, a retired history teacher originally from Boston, traveled from Louisville, Kentucky to visit family and came to Bunker Hill to see the three quotes after learning of the removal order. He called the federal government's move disturbing and said that the country must confront the tragedies and oppressions of the past, not ignore them, to move forward. "I feel like we've stalled out, which is really tragic," he said. "In fact, we're not stalling, we're backsliding." Clint Kovach, 47, a history teacher in Gainesville, Florida, said, "The quote regarding slavery should stand to acknowledge the ongoing oppression of black people, despite their contributions to the country. African Americans have fought in every single war continuously, hoping for equality. And every time they come out of it, it's like, hey, thanks for your service, but you're still a second-class citizen," Kovach said. As a history teacher, Kovach said he feels responsibility to cover all perspectives in the American narrative, even in Florida, where the state has rewritten or removed portions of textbooks. "If I teach something and the kids disagree with it, then that's fine. It's their decision," Kovach said. "If you're going to build an argument based on what you believe, you have to hear what the other side has to say." On Thursday evening, a visitor from the Czech Republic said he was puzzled by the plan. "I don't see the sense in removing them," Joseph Krasik, 35, said. "They're helpful for tourists and for local citizens to get to know the history." Kiera Singleton, executive director of the Royal House and Slave Quarters in Medford, called the plan extremely upsetting and disappointing. "We're in the midst of a celebration of freedom, and we're being reminded of freedom for whom and freedom for whose stories," Singleton said. "You can't talk about that battle without talking about the men of color who put their lives on the line there."
Municipal deficits are growing and layoffs are looming. The override losses, inflation force cuts ahead of the fiscal year. So Malden is slated to lay off 29 public employees, including 5 firefighters. In Somerville, a clinical youth specialist was among the 13 abruptly axed. And in New Bedford, where the exasperated mayor said the financial strife had, in his words, reached a boiling point, the cuts reached deep into the police department ledger with the planned elimination of 24 vacant positions, all while another 36 employees in city departments are set to be let go, and a fire station is on the chopping block. Across Massachusetts, communities are confronting what some describe as the most intractable budget shortfalls in decades. Exact numbers of people losing their jobs may vary as labor negotiations play out, but the budget city leaders are putting forward this year have called for a flurry of program cuts and pink slips in these last weeks before the new fiscal year that begins next month, saying we're going to start to see cuts and layoffs that we haven't seen probably since 2008, 2009, during the Great Recession, said Adam Chaplin, who is the executive director of the Massachusetts Municipal Association, a nonprofit that advocates for local officials. The organization had forewarned of what was coming as far back as October when it issued a report that it called a perfect storm that found revenues would not meet the costs of health insurance, utilities, transportation, pensions, and virtually every other line item, all of which have been pushed higher at a time of significant inflation. The layoffs arrive at a moment when pandemic-era federal grants have dried up and unrestricted state aid, adjusted for inflation, is well below what it was 20 years ago, the report said. In Boston, Mayor Michelle Wu had said the city government is not planning layoffs for the next fiscal year, but is cutting hundreds of vacant positions. However, Boston schools are anticipating significant cuts, as are school districts across the state. The new fiscal year starts in July. Because cities and towns are required to have balanced budgets and are limited by state law in how much they can raise property taxes without a community-wide vote, cuts in municipal spending have come to come from somewhere. Sometimes the news comes swiftly. Emily Marinick, who's the clinical youth specialist who was among the people let go in Somerville, had been preparing for a group session with local kids when she was called into an office and told she was being laid off and had to leave right away, saying, "They kind of just grabbed us like thieves in the night and made us disappear," said Marinick, age 36. The brisk pace of cuts has reminded long-term city officials of the recession that began back in late 2007 with the implosion of the housing market. In some corners, this tops it. "It's the worst I've ever seen," said Chris Simonelli, who is a city councilor in Malden, where the mayor has said the city will need to cut five police cadets, five firefighters, and a library custodian. And they will need its head of public works to oversee the city without help from an assistant director. In all, the city's count for fiscal year 2027 was for 29 currently employed people to lose their jobs, and three other open-ended positions to be slashed. Voters in Malden this year were asked to approve two override proposals to raise taxes more than 2.5% by either $5.4 million or $8.2 million to avoid layoffs. In some communities, among them Arlington and Brookline, such overrides passed, but both in Malden were rejected. There was little appetite for higher taxes on households whose own expenses are going up, Simonelli said, who did not want to support that override. He said, "We knew it was coming, but I didn't think it was going to come this fast," Simonelli said. "But like everywhere else, sometimes you've got to take it on the chin." Other communities are scrambling to avoid layoffs by slashing services instead. South Hadley, where voters this year turned down an override that would have raised property taxes by 50% over 5 years, will dip into its free cash and cut workers' hours, according to town administrator Lisa Wong, but will not lay off any municipal staff for now. The town plans to seek a smaller override next year. For other municipal leaders, layoffs were unavoidable, saying that the reality is that the budget has reached a boiling point, said New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell in a fiery press release announcing the deep cuts in his South Coast city, where he said 94 positions will need to be slashed and a fire station will likely have to be shuttered. New Bedford also plans to reduce library hours, scale back its holiday decorations, and not renew its contract with ShotSpotter, the gunshot detection service, he said. He said, "We will be calling on everyone to sacrifice some more than others," Mitchell said in the statement. For some, whether workers will be laid off is still to be determined. Marblehead on Tuesdays will vote on three possible overrides to cover its funding gap. "The town has simply run out of other places to cut," said Select Board Chair Dan Fox. He said, "A major driver of this is benefits," he said. "It's just something we can't keep up with." If voters in the North Shore coastal community approve the priciest option at $15 million, no one will lose their job, Town Administrator Thatcher Kieser said in an email. If they vote all of them down, Kieser said, Marblehead could need to cut between 45 and 47 people, split about evenly between city and school employees. Its current payroll is about 1,200 employees. Fox hopes that won't be necessary. He said, I feel confident we'll be able to pass an override. It feels like the town understands that we've done what we can with what's in front of us. It's never easy to lay people off, Joe Curtoloni said, the former mayor of Somerville, who oversaw layoffs of his own when the Great Recession decimated cities' budgets, saying that the majority of cost in the budget comes down to personnel, he said. They're all valuable to the community. They're all valuable to the administration. But a municipality has very few options on where to reduce costs. Cutting services or dipping into reserve funds can only go so far in plugging the gap, he said. It's another year or two. In that time, what are you going to do, he said.
Bus driver was cited weeks before the fatal crash, fined for failing to obey signals in New Jersey. The story by Laura Cromaldi of the Globe staff. Weeks before the fatal bus collision in Virginia killed five Massachusetts residents, the bus driver was cited by New Jersey State Police for failing to observe traffic signals, records show. The New Jersey violation, which hasn't been previously been reported, offers a more complete picture of Jing Sheng Dong's commercial driving record leading up to the tragic crash a week ago on Interstate 95. Since obtaining a commercial driver's license in 2024, Dong, 48, has been cited for speeding while driving buses in Maryland and Virginia and accused of misdemeanor trespassing at a truck stop in Virginia, records show. In the New Jersey matter, Dong paid $140 on May 9th to settle a citation for failing to obey signal signs or directions. He was ticketed on Route 33 in Robbinsville, New Jersey, near Trenton, online court records show. The records don't specify what kind of vehicle Dong was driving, and New Jersey State Police, which issued the citation, didn't respond Friday to a request for comment. Since the fatal crash in Virginia, federal transportation officials have publicly feuded with the New York State Licensing Agency over granting Dong a commercial driving credential. Last week, U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said in a social media post that Dong, a naturalized citizen from China, does not speak English. On Wednesday, a spokesperson for the New York Department of Motor Vehicles said Dong passed a commercial driver's license skills test in Virginia in 2024 and then applied for the credential in New York, where he lives, on Staten Island. Under Secretary Duffy's own rules, New York was required to accept those results, Walter McClure, the spokesperson, said in a statement. In the same statement, McClure also accused Duffy of heartless politicizing of a tragedy. On Thursday, the U.S. Department of Transportation said in an email that New York initially refused to provide basic information about Dong's driving history, and the agency issued a federal subpoena to get details. In the same email, the agency also accused New York of politicizing roadway safety. The Virginia Department of Motor Vehicles on Friday did not address the question about whether Dong passed the commercial driving skills test in that state. In an email, the agency said driver licensing information is privileged under federal law, under Virginia law, rather. Under federal rules that states must follow for commercial driver's licenses, applicants must take their skills tests in English and cannot use an interpreter. Officers from two different police officers in Virginia wrote in incident reports that Dong struggled with English, records show. Last year, the Trump administration implemented a harsher penalty for enforcing English language drivers requirements for drivers who operate in commercial vehicles across state lines. The revisions mandated that drivers who cannot communicate in English be taken off the road immediately. Previously, the toughest penalty for such drivers faced was a citation. Dong faces five counts of involuntary manslaughter and a misdemeanor charge of reckless driving in connection to the fatal crash. The collision killed a family of four from Greenfield. Ekaterina and Dmitry Donsev and their children, Emily, 14, and Mark, 7. Priscilla Mafalda, 25, of Worcester, who was traveling with her husband, Igor Ernesto, was also killed. Mafalda is originally from Brazil. On Tuesday, Correio Brasilianese, a Brazilian news organization, reported that Ernesto's brother-in-law and his wife had also been treated and released from a hospital for injuries they sustained in the crash. Investigators say the collision happened at about 2:35 a.m. on May 29th as the bus approached a work zone where vehicles had slowed for traffic near Quantico, Virginia. The bus slammed into several vehicles before coming to a halt on the other side of the road, authorities said. Dong was operating the bus on behalf of E&P Travel, Inc. of Kings Mountain, North Carolina, and taking passengers from New York City to Charlotte, North Carolina, authorities said. The crash remains under investigation by Virginia State Police and the National Transportation Safety Board. Dong was hospitalized after the collision, and there were no updates Friday about his status, according to the Stafford Commonwealth's attorney, the prosecutor in Virginia handling the case. Dong is expected to make his first court appearance via video once he's released from the hospital, the office said.
And from the cover story of today's Boston Globe, this headline that Massachusetts limits insurers' use of what's known as prior authorization. Dr. Deborah Shapiro and her staff spend hours in their Cambridge practice each week asking permission from insurers to prescribe their primary care patients with certain medications and procedures. The arduous process, known as prior authorization, eats up their time and delays care for Shapiro's patients experiencing pressing ailments like chest pain, intestinal infections, and even cancer. But on Friday, the Healy administration took steps to ease those headaches, issuing rules that limit when insurers can require prior authorization for prescriptions and tests, along with visits to certain providers. The regulations are meant to restrict the red tape surrounding some essential services and medications for managing chronic diseases, including diabetes and asthma. They also establish protections for patients who switch insurance providers, and they ban prior authorizations for physical, occupational, and speech therapies for maternity services and medications for serious mental illness, among other changes. The decision over which services and medications to exempt from prior authorizations were determined following hearings with the stakeholders, even health insurers, which view prior authorization as a critical tool for controlling healthcare spending, have signed into the regulations. Governor Mara Healey and supporters say the reforms will make accessing care faster and cheaper, while lessening some of the paperwork burden for the providers, saying that these changes will make the healthcare system work better for patients and providers, while helping people get the right care at the right time, Healy said in a statement. State Insurance Commissioner Michael Kalu said it will likely take until the end of the year for patients to see any changes from those regulations. The state will hold a series of education sessions with insurers and providers before starting to enforce the measures. What is harder to predict, experts say, is just how much of an impact these rules will actually have for patients and doctors. The state's regulatory authority only covers plans that account for about half of the people who purchase insurance in the commercial market. Calmia said there are those people who employers are fully insured, meaning their insurer takes on the financial responsibility for paying out medical claims. The regulations will not apply to self-insured employers that pay health care claims directly, the majority of employers. That means large employers could still choose to require prior authorizations in the areas that Healy has restricted. Other insurance plans that are exempt from the regulations include government insurance programs for low-income residents and seniors, including MassHealth and Medicare, as well as the Group Insurance Commission that covers public employees, retirees, and their families, saying that for providers there will still be a substantial amount of uncertainty and administrative burden related to prior authorizations because of the differing rules based on insurance type, said Aaron Schwartz, who's the assistant professor of health policy at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Medicine. Experts, including Schwartz, said it will take time to see whether the changes help patients get care sooner. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, the state's largest commercial insurer, offers both plans that are regulated by the Division of Insurance and plans that are not. The organization has not decided whether it will implement the new regulations for the plans that are not overseen by the division. The insurer is seeking more details on certain provisions, including the elimination of prior authorizations for medications treating serious mental illness and outpatient substance use disorder services, saying that there are some areas we see fraud that without any prior authorization, we'd be blind to, a Blue Cross spokesperson said. Blue Cross Chief Medical Officer Dr. Sonia Reo added that the organization already follows many of the new regulations. Less than 2% of insurance claims at Blue Cross are subject to prior authorization, she said. For years, Massachusetts healthcare industry has been weighed down by skyrocketing costs and uncontrolled spending as the state wades through the rubble of reduced federal insurance subsidies for low and middle income residents and stares down impending work requirements for mass health enrollees. Leaders are scrambling to find any way to bolster a shaky system.
Trump officials plan to mark 2.7 million living people as dead, whistleblower claims. The plan would have classified 2.7 million people as dead. And the photo on page A2 shows Jeremiah Schofield, who revealed a Trump administration plan to falsely mark 2.7 million people as dead. The story is from the Washington Post by Merrill Cornfield. The Trump administration had plans to classify 2.7 million living people, including some U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents, as dead as part of its immigration enforcement efforts, according to a former senior Social Security executive. The previously unreported plan, which the Social Security Administration said was not carried out, would have used one of the government's most consequential identity databases to effectively erase people from the financial system, potentially cutting them off from wages, banking, government benefits, and other services. Jeremiah Schofield, who worked at the Social Security for 25 years and helped lead the agency's IT modernization efforts before leaving in October, said he refused to help implement the plan after agency lawyers warned that falsely marking living people as dead could violate federal law. Schofield said he realized the plan's possible intent to intimidate and worsen the finances of immigrants, as well as potential unlawfulness after taking a sample of people from the 2.7 million and discovering they were all alive. Some were U.S. citizens, lawful permanent residents, teenagers, and senior citizens, including one widow who was a legal permanent resident receiving survivor benefits. Schofield has provided details on the plan in a 49-page whistleblower disclosure to Democratic senators Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, who's on the Senate Finance Committee, and Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, the ranking member of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. The disclosure was reviewed by the Washington Post, and it offers the most detailed account yet of how officials from Elon Musk's U.S. DOGE service sought to use Social Security data in service of President Trump's immigration crackdown. In an interview with the Post, Schofield said he is speaking publicly for the first time because he believes Americans need to understand how government data can be misused and in some cases already has been. Social Security carried out a smaller version of such an effort last year, moving 6,100 immigrants to its Death Master File, a database used by banks, employers, and government agencies to determine whether someone is alive. Some of those people later showed up at Social Security field offices to prove they were alive and were restored in agency records. In a written statement, a Social Security spokesperson, who did not provide their name, said the agency did not add a list of 2.7 million names to the Death Master File. SSA maintains the highest level of internal controls. This includes having all the appropriate policies and procedures in place to maintain the integrity and accuracy of agency records. Schofield's whistleblower complaint describes a tumultuous period inside Social Security as career officers questioned the legality of such efforts and watched DOGE officials gain access to some of the government's most sensitive databases. In one meeting, Schofield said, a DOGE official working with the Department of Homeland Security described the goal of declaring 2.7 million living people dead, making immigrants so miserable that they self-deported or went to Social Security offices for help where they could be arrested. That call was one of the most disappointing calls I've ever been in my 25-year career, Schofield said in the interview. I was shocked. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Department of Homeland Security spokeswoman Lauren Biss did not respond to questions about the plan, but said that sharing information across agencies can be beneficial and attacked the Biden administration's immigration policies. Being moved into the death master file can be devastating to someone who is still alive because it can cut off their financial access. Last year, career staff warned that falsely giving people death dates could be catastrophic, though the administration overrode those objectives. If you're on the death master list, death master file, you can't have a bank account, you can't get credit, so no apartment, no way to save money, no way to get paid, no way to get on insurance or carry health insurance, according to a former Social Security official who spoke on condition of anonymity to describe internal debates. It has a ton of devastating effects. In the past year, two other whistleblowers have also shared concerns about Americans' personal information being accessed and shared by DOJ. One whistleblower, former Social Security Chief Data Officer Charles Borges, alleged DOJ members shared data through third-party services and placed Americans' personal data information on a cloud. A second whistleblower anonymously claimed in disclosures to the Inspector General that a DOJ member allegedly took a thumb drive of Americans' data to a private company, which is being investigated by the agency's watchdog. When Schofield left Social Security in October, he did not expect to blow the whistle. He said he followed legal requirements to destroy documents in his possession. He had told family and other coworkers about the call when it happened, but otherwise kept quiet as he watched other civil service workers facing retaliation in the Trump administration. But months later, he told another former federal worker he was haunted by what he had seen and how Social Security data had been compromised, and she encouraged him to speak out.
Public transit bounces back as gas prices remain high. As the Iran war enters its fourth month, ridership on U.S. public transit systems is rising as gasoline prices remain near historic highs. Weekday commutes on Los Angeles County's metro system, for instance, jumped nearly 8% between January and May, saying that with gas prices in April averaging roughly $5.70 per gallon, the ability to travel across the country for just $1.75 makes rail an increasingly attractive and cost-effective alternative, Maya Progdes said. She's the Senior Director of Communications for LA's metro system. Transportation agencies in Boston, Chicago, and other cities also report growing ridership. Experts said it remains unclear to what extent gas prices are driving a switch to public transit versus other factors, such as a return to office mandates and the ongoing recovery from the pandemic. But a May report from the New York Federal Reserve found that low and moderate income households have decreased their consumption of gasoline as pump prices spike, potentially by carpooling or substituting to public transportation where available. California's gas costs are 41% higher than the U.S. average. Regular gas in the Golden State hovers above $6 a gallon, with premium fuel edging toward $7. And the state has seen notable increases in public transit use. In San Diego County, light rail ridership jumped nearly 18% between February and April, compared to an 11% increase for the same period last year, according to the latest available data. Chicago experienced an 11% increase between January and April, with more interest from lower-income customers, according to a spokesperson for the city's transit authority. Ridership on Boston's rail line rose 13%. With the Iran war at a stalemate, gas prices are expected to remain high throughout 2026. After the oil shocks of 2008 and again in 2022, drivers largely returned to their old habits when gas prices declined. Experts said that though this is the second sudden run-up in gas prices in 4 years and comes amid persistent inflation and geopolitical upheaval, it may not result in a significant switch to public transportation, though it could cut driving That's because people now have more alternatives, according to David King, an associate professor in the School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning. He said, if we don't drive, some trips might turn to transit, some trips might turn to work from home, some trips might turn to delivery, some are going to be biking or walking, he said, noting people can also keep driving but switch to an electric vehicle.
Bids begin in the wildlife refuge auction. Trump aims for oil drilling leases in Arctic Alaska. The story by Jake Spring of the Washington Post. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum and Energy Secretary Chris Wright, along with Environmental Protection Agency Chief Lee Zeldin, flew to Uqtdivik in the North Slope tundra on the Arctic Ocean last June on a mission to unleash Alaska's extraordinary resource potential. On Friday, just over 1 year later, that pledge is being put to the test in the Trump administration's auction of oil leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, a pristine expanse the size of South Carolina that is home to caribou, polar bear, and millions of migrating birds. Two corporations bid on a handful of leases, a showing critics described as tepid, but one that further opens the door to possible development in the pristine region. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, a state corporation that already has leases in the refuge's coastal plain, had the winning bid on three tracts, and Hex Energy LLC on two, the Bureau of Land Management announced. The tracts cover about 72,000 acres. Nearly 690,000 acres have been offered. Winning bids totaled $3.7 million. The federal agency's state director, Kevin Penegras, said, a new era of active leasing and exploration is just beginning to unfold. The sale is part of the administration's broad push to open Alaska to development by expanding drilling on public land and in federal waters, greenlighting a 211-mile mining road north of the Arctic Circle, and advancing a new natural gas pipeline across the state. These efforts, some of which jumpstart energy and infrastructure projects that have stalled for decades, have horrified environmental advocates and divided Alaska Native communities. Administration officials say drilling and mining in Alaska will help meet energy and resource needs, bolster national security, and strengthen the Alaskan and U.S. economies. This lease sale certainly fits the broader pattern of putting drilling and development and extraction interests ahead of conservation and public access and long-term stewardship, said Greg Dubai, a senior staff attorney at the Wilderness Society, an advocacy group that is suing to block development of the refuge. This administration is treating these lands as something that should be given away as assets when we think they should be protected for future generations, Dubai added. Voice of Arctic Inupiat, an advocacy coalition that represents 22 indigenous groups on the North Slope, supports drilling in Anwar if it is done correctly and brings economic benefits to the community, said its president, Nagruk Harcharek. Parts of the proceeds from the oil development on the refuge would be distributed among these communities. From the North Slope perspective, we want it because it makes economic sense for us, Harcharek said. We benefit from that economic development. We reinvest that money in our communities. Sovereign Inupiat for a Living Arctic opposes the drilling and denounced the Interior Department's decision to rescind Biden-era protections for the refuge in October, as well as an earlier decision to reinstate the leases that a statewide development corporation bought in the refuge in 2021. But with oil prices spiking amid the war in Iran and with a favorable administration, this auction could be different, according to an oil industry official who spoke on condition of anonymity because the official was not authorized to speak to the media ahead of the auction. The refuge is not far from the start of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline at Brudhoy Bay, which has the extra capacity to bring the oil to market, this person said. The economics of drilling in the refuge are similar to exploration further the east on the other side of the Prudhoe Bay in the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska, with development costing probably only a few more dollars per barrel in the refuge. A March auction of reserve areas drew significant interest, resulting in 187 lease areas sold worth $163 million, covering 1.3 million acres in the 23 million acre reserve. The person said that drilling in the refuge is riskier than in the petroleum reserve, where oil has already been successfully developed, also in part because environmental groups will fight harder to stop it in the refuge. Before leasing in the refuge was written into a tax and spending bill during Trump's first term, development there had been off limits for roughly half a century. Environmental groups, including the Wilderness Society, are challenging the administration's steps to opening the refuge to drilling, which they argue violates the Endangered Species Act and laws governing refuges. Building roads and oil infrastructure in the refuge will fragment wildlife habitat and disrupt migration of porcupine caribou, which travel thousands of miles to the coastal plain to give birth, DeVos said. It also presents risks to polar bears, which are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, which digs dens in the areas while raising their young. Oil companies bring these giant thumper trucks in and start pounding the ground during the winter, right on top of where the polar bears are denning, he said. It crushes the cubs. The mothers abandon the dens. As far as whether development can occur responsibly, obviously we don't think so, Dubai added. This land is pristine and too fragile to support major industrial activities.
And taking a look at the business section of today's Boston Globe, this headline, patients bringing AI into doctor's offices presents new challenges. Patients are getting used to being recorded in the doctor's office. More than a quarter of U.S. practices now use AI-based listening tools called ambient scribes, which capture visits in real time and draft clinical notes for clinicians to enter into patients' medical records. But what happens when it's the patient doing the recording? Nearly every patient now has a recording device in their pocket, and commercial large language models have made it easier than ever for them to transcribe and interpret audio files. A growing number of consumer apps with names like Visit Recall and Advocate Health and Align Care are using AI to do just that, delivering summaries and action items for patients after the fact. In their most vulnerable moments, patient app developers say people can use the extra help to remember everything their doctor says. They see value in providing a single place where a patient can track all their encounters across health systems, sometimes for free, sometimes for a monthly fee. Beyond summarization, AI could make it easier to follow up on important instructions and share them with family and caregiving teams. He said it's more about stitching together than it is about the content itself, said Kin, CEO and founder of the Akinpakit. But the tool also introduces challenging questions for patients about privacy and security of health data when it's stored and processed outside of a provider's digital walls. And patients using their own AI tools could lead to tensions in the doctor's office as those tools create an alternate record of what happened in a visit. Health information collected by a doctor's office falls under the privacy known as the HIPAA. But when outside those offices, whether a patient requests their own records or inputs their data into a consumer app, those rules no longer apply. Saying that this is kind of concerning because this is very sensitive information, said Sarah Gurka, professor at the University of Illinois College of Law. She said health systems often implement policies that quickly delete the raw audio and transcripts collected by their ambient scribes. What happens to that data on the patient's side? Some patient apps claim to treat health data as if it were regulated by HIPAA to keep it private and secure. Some because they say it's the right thing to do, others because they see a world in which they could start working directly with health systems and want to be HIPAA ready. Some don't store recordings or transcripts or delete them after a certain period of time, similar to health systems that use ambient scribes. But privacy experts remind patients that consumer products can change their terms of use and privacy policies whenever they want without negotiation. And that fine print varies widely between apps, saying, are they going to share the data? In which format? Are they sharing de-identified information, or even, hopefully not, the individually identifiable information, Girk asked.
The Forest Service is to open millions of acres to ATVs, by Lisa Friedman of the New York Times. The Trump administration is preparing to allow off-road vehicles on millions of acres of national forest land, according to a draft order prepared for Brooke Rollins, the Agriculture Secretary. The move is a companion to President Trump's decision May 29th to repeal two executive orders that for decades had protected other public lands, including most national parks, from ATVs, dirt bikes, and other off-road vehicles. The undated Agriculture Department secretarial memorandum, which was reviewed by the New York Times, directs the Forest Service to identify which closed roads, trails, areas, airstrips, and waterways in each national forest might be considered for year-round recreational access. The memo would also immediately allow off-road vehicles in areas that the Forest Service has recommended to Congress should be granted wilderness protections. Right now, ATVs are not allowed in many of those areas, which are treated as if they were protected already. That move alone affects about 5 million acres, primarily in Idaho and Montana. As the United States marks 250 years of independence in 2026, we must shine a light on our nation's greatest national treasures and ensure every American can recreate on these majestic lands, the memo said. Michael Aboud, a spokesperson for the Agriculture Department, said in a statement that the agency is committed to ensuring Americans can responsibly access and enjoy their public lands while maintaining strong stewardship of national resources. The pair of policies encouraging off-road vehicles is part of a Trump administration effort to de-emphasize conservation and promote recreation and economic activity on public lands. In the coming weeks, the Forest Service is expected to issue a proposal to rescind a Clinton-era regulation that prevents new road building in nearly 60 million acres of undeveloped land. The Bureau of Land Management has proposed to repeal a Biden-era rule that allowed public lands to be leased for conservation purposes. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed opening 95% of wildlife refuges to hunting and fishing. Dan Hardinger, the senior policy director at the Wilderness Society, an environmental group, said ATVs, dirt bikes, and other off-road vehicles could severely damage wilderness areas. These are some of the wildest natural areas we have left in our forests, Hardinger said. In particular, he argued, allowing off-road vehicles in areas the agency has recommended to be protected threatens our ability to ever protect them in the future if they're irrevocably damaged. Currently, the Forest Service has a lengthy process for evaluating and recommending to Congress land that could be included in the National Wilderness Preservation System. Only Congress holds the authority to officially designate land as wilderness and grant it special protections. But once a recommendation is made, the Forest Service is obligated to protect the qualities of the land that made it eligible for recommendation in the first place. Under the draft order, the Forest Service will manage recommended wilderness areas for what is known as multiple use, which aims to balance commercial, recreational, and conservation activities. It also calls to restore access to uses and levels prior to recommendation as wilderness within 30 days. One executive order that Trump repealed last week was signed by President Nixon in 1972. It established strict criteria for the use of off-road vehicles on federal lands in an effort to minimize their environmental impact. The second, signed by President Carter in 1977, authorized the government to immediately shut down off-road driving if it was causing ecological damage.
Democrats stop production of the commemorative gold coin. Senate Democrats on Thursday urged the Trump administration to halt production of a commemorative 250th anniversary solid gold coin that would bear the president's image, citing concerns that some of the U.S. Mint's gold could have links to foreign cartels. A federal arts commission staffed with Trump appointees in March approved the 24-carat coin, which would show President Trump leaning on a desk with clenched fists and be up to 3 inches in diameter, a design approved by the president. But the coin should be shelved because of recent reports that some gold used by the Mint was sourced from countries where the precious metal is mined illegally. Senators Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts and Ron Wyden of Oregon, the top Democrats on the Senate Banking and Finance Committee, said respectively, argued in a letter to the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Mint Director Paul Hollis that it was viewed by the Washington Post. The New York Times in April reported on the foreign supply chain for American gold, including gold from Colombian mines controlled by drug cartels or Peruvian and Mexican pawn shops. The gold has been sourced from other countries for years across Democratic and Republican administrations, according to the Times, saying at the very least, the Mint should ensure that a coin intended to honor the nation's 250th anniversary is not made of gold linked to exploitation and criminal activity. Warren and Wyden both wrote, asking the Mint to stop all production on the coin and conduct a public audit of the supply chain. They said the coin is more befitting of a monarchy than a democracy. Similar commemorative coins typically sell for thousands of dollars. And that brings us near the top of the hour. Thanks for joining us for today's Boston Globe.